Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chair of the Humanities Forum, and we organize today's event. I'd like to welcome our radio and online listening audiences, and I'd like to introduce our speaker tonight, who's Daniel Sharp, the new CEO of the Eisenhower Foundation. He's going to be talking about the legacy from Ike, that is country over principles, something that's quite useful today. And I'm glad that you're here to hear it. And I hope that a lot of people hear this talk on the online and radio portions, because we often say that the mess is just too big to handle today. We have so many problems. We've got Afghanistan. We've got Iraq. We've got, you know, our financial issues and so on. You know, if you went back to 1952, you know, you're talking about the start of a nuclear, you know, war, Cold War era. You're talking about the Soviet Union, not, you know, Al-Qaeda, quite a different size enemy. You're talking about also stagnated economy, trying to recover after the devastation of the war and get everybody back into production instead of, you know, just being soldiers. Now, of course, he was 7 years after, but even so, in Europe, was still recovering. All those problems were extremely huge, and at the same time, you know, the interstate system was put into place. All kinds of big projects were done as well. So I think very instructive to hear from that period of time, especially when the idea of a moderate Republican has apparently disappeared from view. So, Daniel Sharp, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much, George. It's a great pleasure and a special one for me to come back to the Commonwealth Club. I was a member when I was a young lawyer here as Deputy Attorney General of the state many years ago. And I understand the international relations section had something to do with tonight's program as well. My father created the international relations section many years ago, and I was an officer of it when I was here. So this is coming home for me, and it's a great honor and a pleasure to be with you. George, thank you very much for setting up the talk. Basically, what I want to do is exactly what George described, is to tell you a series of stories about how Eisenhower handled the problem when there were conflicts between what was in the national interest and what was in the party interest, or what was in his own personal interest. Why is that important today? I think George actually answered that question. We need that sort of a model. And at the end, I'm going to suggest that if Americans knew as much about Eisenhower as they know about so many of our other presidents, we might have an alternative model of presidential leadership against which to measure our candidates. Let me give you a brief summary of his life. I don't know if you can see the print in back. I'll run through this pretty quickly, but it's a helpful perspective on who the man was. It's important to know he was born in the 19th century in Texas in the South. He grew up in Abilene, Kansas, which he said very much shaped his values. He grew up in a small home, and I'll show you its picture. There were six boys, all the size of Eisenhower, all enormous, and they grew up sharing bedrooms in a very tiny house, which had rather little money. He was busy working in a creamery and doing odd jobs when, fortuitously, he got appointed to West Point. Among his various tours was working under General Douglas MacArthur, which came back to haunt him later on. And he's most known for, of course, what he did in World War II. He was brought to Washington originally as a planner, and planning was central to his approach throughout his life. And he very soon came under the direct supervision of General George Marshall, who became his mentor, his boss, and really his devoted supervisor. It therefore came as a surprise both to Marshall and Eisenhower when Franklin Roosevelt chose Eisenhower over Marshall to be the Supreme Allied Commander. As we'll see during the time, both men were very humble men and did not advertise themselves. And Marshall really wanted the job, but it was not in his character to advocate for himself, nor did Eisenhower. So it was up to Roosevelt to make the decision. After the war, briefly, he was, as his grandson says, the military dictator of the occupied zone of Germany for 6 months. And then he was brought back to Washington to replace General Marshall as Army Chief of Staff. He then went to Columbia University over a 5-year period as its president. However, he didn't take it all totally seriously. He took a year off to become the first head of NATO. And a less known fact of great importance to me, he took 6 months off to tour the country to create the American Assembly, which for him was the institutionalization of the democratic process. I had the honor of being its CEO for 15 years, and I'm very happy to tell you about it. It's an extraordinary organization that would bring together the leaders of various thoughts on the most critical issues facing the United States, and we did a lot of track two diplomacy with the government, with the leaders of China and Japan and the European community and so on. And this was all carrying out Eisenhower's belief that democracy would work better if there was this deliberative process. He then, of course, was our 34th president, and he died in 1969. This is the home he grew up in, and it looks rather larger than it is. I'll show you a picture later on that puts it in appropriate size. This house is preserved on our Eisenhower Foundation campus in Abilene, Kansas. What I'd like to do now is do a quick list of his major accomplishments and then tell you 8 stories about those that demonstrate the principle that I want. But I think for perspective, it would be helpful to look at this list because other than the first and the last items, these come from a letter that Eisenhower wrote to his friend and press secretary, Jim Haggerty, who asked him, "Would you tell me what you think your major accomplishments are?" So here we have Eisenhower's own judgment about what he thought was most important. However, the first one was not on his list, and to me it is one of the most important ones. It has not come into public knowledge yet that he, on several occasions, prevented the use of nuclear weapons. And he stopped an attack on China, which I have learned about from a friend who was the officer of the deck on one of the 3 carriers in this enormous 3-carrier task force of about 50 ships that were in the straits between Formosa, or Taiwan now, and China, ready to attack Red China. And it was 20 minutes from launching that attack when Eisenhower canceled it. He was frequently presented with unanimous recommendations from his cabinet and from the military chiefs to delegate the authority to use nuclear weapons down to the field level. And he knew that was tantamount to starting a war, and he blocked it. And yet, at the same time, he kept the United States strong enough to resist any kind of attack during his 8 years. As he said, we had peace, we also had prosperity. Okay, the rest of this list comes from his letter to Jim Haggerty, except for the last item. He ended the Korean War. Remember his 1952 campaign promise, "I will go to Korea if elected." He did, and he ended the war. He appointed Earl Warren, well known here as a former governor, as Chief Justice. He's very proud of his Adams for Peace speech to the UN. These are in chronological order, not in priority order. The St. Lawrence Seaway was built during his time. He desegregated Washington, D.C., and the entire armed forces, implementing a 5-year-old executive order issued by President Truman but never implemented. And historians now believe that what Eisenhower did really was the effective start of integration in the South. He did not intervene in Vietnam. He was under great pressure from the French, who were losing their war in Indochina in Dien Bien Phu, a lesson we never learned. But he kept us out. He extended Social Security to 7.5 million more Americans, much to the distress of his party, or at least the conservative wing of it. He did work very hard as a bipartisan leader to pass the Formosa Resolution, which authorized the use of force to defend Formosa, but did not authorize attacking China. He reopened the dialogue with the Soviet Union. As George mentioned, he built the interstate highway system. The next item I added, and I'll explain why in a moment, he vetoed the Natural Gas Act, even though it was his legislation, because he was concerned about the lobbying. He did not back his wartime allies of Britain and France when they attacked Egypt to capture the Suez Canal. And that led to the Eisenhower Doctrine. I'll discuss that in some detail. It's quite a significant decision and result. He is known for sending the federal troops into Little Rock, and this was an extraordinarily difficult and important decision. He did it in order to implement a federal court order emanating from the famous Brown versus Board of Education decision, which Earl Warren led the court to make. And I'll discuss all of the civil rights issues in a little bit more detail. But in his list, he was proud to list the Civil Rights Act of 57 and 60, which were the first civil rights legislation in 82 years. He started the space program, built NASA, and then he did not list in his letter to Jim Haggerty his farewell address. I find that extraordinary. It's one of the more lasting messages, his warning of the military-industrial complex. David Nichols, who's written a couple of books on him recently and who validated this presentation, among others that I submitted it to make sure it was accurate, said, please be sure to tell everyone that although he did not list it among his major accomplishments, he was deeply concerned that we were becoming a militarized, almost a garrison state, and that in that process, we would not only destroy our economy, but we would lose our American values and our democracy. I was a political science major at Berkeley, so a slight detour here on the concept of divided government, because Eisenhower was the first president after 20 years of one-party government to have to live with a Congress that he did not control. When he was initially elected, you can see in the first Congress in 53-54, he had a very slight margin in both the House and the Senate, somewhat like Obama in his first 2 years. In his third and fourth years, the Democrats took control of the House, but not yet the Senate. And then during his reelection, he lost further ground. The Democrats took control of both the houses, and they strengthened their lead all during the time. And I make this point about divided government because it's all the more remarkable when you see what he accomplished through bipartisan negotiation and through his leadership. Just for quick perspective, as I mentioned, FDR had one-party rule for his whole term, Truman for most of his. JFK and LBJ for all of their terms was one-party rule. But then starting with Reagan, it was either 50 or 100% of the time they had divided government, which seems to be the new pattern and kind of an American emerging tradition of wanting a divided government. Of course, our Constitution was created with checks and balances in order to make sure not too much happened. But one of the consequences of divided government is you get limited government actions. That's the end of the poli-sci detour to Berkeley. Now, this is a list of the eight stories I want to tell you. These are the ones from which we derive this notion of when and how Eisenhower chose to put national interest, country, above other interests. I think I'll just leave the list for a moment. I won't read through it, but I'm going to talk about each of these eight subjects. So let me start with the Bricker Amendment. I know some of you remember Senator Bricker from Ohio, for whom the amendment was named. He was not the only one, but he was the leading advocate of amending the U.S. Constitution to prevent the president from having the power to negotiate international agreements. And this was during a time like now when the right wing is hostile to everything international and to the UN. Bricker's was the main proposed amendment. And in 1953, which was Eisenhower's first year, in 54, it came very close to being passed and would have passed as an amendment to the Constitution if it weren't for Eisenhower's very aggressive blocking of it. And he had three reasons why he was against it. The first was that he was concerned about the isolationists within this country and in his own party. And he thought that if he could oppose the Bricker Amendment, he could block the isolationists. Secondly, he was very concerned to protect the Constitution, which he constantly did, like sending in the troops to respect the court order. And he thought that if that amendment went through, it would create an imbalance of power between the executive and the legislative branch. And finally, he felt that as a national leader and as a world leader, it would limit his ability to advocate for America's national interests. So he blocked the amendment, and in the process, he substantially reduced the power of the isolationists. I want to add one footnote. David Eisenhower, who is the chairman of the Eisenhower Foundation and President Eisenhower's grandson, after whom Camp David is named, said, please tell everybody that, in effect, what Eisenhower did by blocking the isolationists was to create what he calls the presidential wing of the Republican Party. And he said the reason that he makes that point is that Eisenhower's was the first of a series of six Republican administrations, not nonstop, but at least David believes that the way in which Eisenhower fashioned his leadership created a foundation for subsequent Republican presidents. The other story I want to tell you is probably even more obscure. I would doubt that many of you have heard of Project Solarium. It's absolutely fascinating to me. For background, it started with a secret cable by George Kennan when he was in the U.S. mission in the Soviet Union. George Kennan has been revived in American thought right now by a fabulous biography by John Gaddis of Yale that's just been published. Some of you may have seen early reviews of it. But Kennan is the one who coined the phrase and the policy called containment. And this was during the Truman administration. And Truman embraced containment, meaning that we will limit the continued Soviet expansion by whatever means, through Voice of America and through foreign aid, but not through going to war with them. And for that reason, when Eisenhower became president, the Republicans who had more or less embraced it under Truman changed their view, partially because John Foster Dulles took a very strong line on this, but the Republican leaders in Congress, even on the White House staff, and his cabinet, felt that containment was too passive. And as you know, there was kind of a Red Scare, and there was a very, very great anxiety about what Russia would do. And they developed two alternative strategies. One they called rollback. And this was the liberationists, the ones who wanted to go to war with the Soviet Union, and eventually, if necessary, they wanted, with military means, to push the Soviet Union out of Central Europe and back to their own borders. The other alternative I call the red line strategy. It's a bit of a pun because it's the extent of the Red Army, and it's a line in the sand, but it's a red line. And this policy said that if Russia crosses this line in any way, we will retaliate as massively as necessary, up to and including nuclear weapons. And that was the stated line. I might say the liberation strategy was part of the Republican 1952 platform on which Eisenhower ran. So here he is with an administration with three different points of view about what our overall strategy towards our major enemy should be. And to me, it is fascinating what Eisenhower did about it. He brought together the leading advocates of each of these three policies. And he said, I'm going to create three teams of seven people each. And each one will be bipartisan, and it will have people from the intelligence, the military, the economic, the political side of government. And I want each of these three teams to go off for 6 weeks and do whatever you've got to do to create the strongest possible defense of your recommendation. He then brought teams A, B, and C together with the National Security Council for an entire day. And he sat there for more than 8 hours as they went through, averaging about 3 hours each, explaining and defending their point of view. And at the end of that time, he stood up, having taken no notes, and spoke for 45 minutes, summarizing everything that had happened, absolutely stunning even the experts with his mastery. And I have Kennan's quote to that effect, and Kennan was a Democrat, although his enthusiasm has to be explained in part by the fact that at the end of the day, Eisenhower embraced his containment policy. The result of this was really very significant because he again defied the conservative wing of his party for what he thought was necessary to protect the national interest. It was very clear that the rollback and redline policies would have led to military engagement with the Soviet Union, and he didn't want that to happen. So he chose country over party. It was a very clear case. And it's important to put the Bricker and Solarium together because the conservative wing of his party was partially isolationist, and it was partially liberationist. And what he did is he blocked the isolationists by defeating Bricker, and he blocked the liberationists by setting the Solarium Project on containment. And I also mentioned this because this kind of thoughtful deliberation as a strategy planning model is a model that you could use today anywhere in government or in business or anywhere else. It really is. It was a profound story. Let me turn to the Suez Canal. This is a very old map, but it shows... is this working? Where's the red dot? Well, it's small. But Egypt was more or less a sovereign country. I say more or less, as I will show you here. Egypt became independent, more or less, in 1922 under a treaty with England. But British control lasted more or less through the end of World War II, 1945. And by 1956, when the incident that I'll describe occurred, Britain still had 80,000 troops on Egyptian territory next to the canal. And before I describe the event, I think it's important to give you the sense of where Eisenhower's mind was when this incident occurred. It's very clear that World War II made him a firm defender of avoiding further war. And this was the statement that he made then. We believe that the power of modern weapons makes war not only perilous but preposterous. And the only way to win World War III is to prevent it. Now, that seems kind of trite now. I mean, it's something we take for granted. But it was not in 1956 or before when he made this statement, because we had a different perspective on it. So he believed that at all costs we should avoid getting into another world war. Now, I apologize for the busy chart, but I'll walk you through it, and you can ignore it and just listen to me or follow it on the chart if you want. What was happening in 1956 was that Eisenhower, together with Dulles, who was working very closely with him on this, were working to improve our position with Egypt so that we could broker an Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty. Does that sound familiar? I mean, they have the peace treaty, but we're still struggling. He felt then that that was the key to solving the problems in the Middle East. And we were also concerned to prevent Soviet influence. At that time, Nasser was very cleverly playing the United States and Britain, the United States and Russia off against each other, and it was allegedly, secretly, but we knew he was doing it. Nasser was negotiating with the Russians for money, and he was trying to get us to money for what? To build the Aswan Dam, which was one of the world's great projects. And Eisenhower decided that we should support it financially, not only because we wanted to build good relations with Egypt, but because we wanted to prevent Soviet influence in the region. But he had one of his heart attacks during this period. 1956 was a terrible year for him. And while he was sick, Dulles maneuvered more or less to persuade him that Congress would not support it, and he got Eisenhower to cancel the offer to Nasser. Nasser was outraged. He seized the canal. At which point, what did the Europeans do? Britain and France secretly, allegedly, started preparing to grab the canal with military force together with Israel. So Eisenhower publicly says that the canal is a global public utility. Military action cannot be used to seize it without international sanction. So Eisenhower went to the Security Council. Sort of sounds familiar, like some of recent our frustrating experiences. And guess who vetoed it in this case? Britain and France vetoed it. Russia supported us at that time. Well, as a consequence of that, feeling that they had been liberated by the absence of the Security Council vote, England and France invaded Egypt. And so then did Israel. And what do you think Nasser did? Well, he sank a whole bunch of ships and blocked the canal. So the world's in pretty bad shape here. And Eisenhower makes this quotation that here Eisenhower was outraged and was really furious that we had to choose between supporting, in effect, a colonial power or a rule of law. So he mobilized the world community, worked through the IMF with Saudi Arabia, with all the other European countries, put economic pressure on England and France, and got a ceasefire fairly quickly. And he then talked Israel into withdrawing as well. So what are the consequences of this action? Well, for one thing, the canal was out of commission for 6 months because it took that long to clear all of the ships. Secondly, Egyptian sovereignty was reaffirmed. Not that Eisenhower got any public credit from Nasser for that. He thanked him privately and then thanked Khrushchev publicly. And Eisenhower, in effect, saved Nasser's neck. If he had backed England and France, Nasser would have been gone. And it is interesting to think about how the Middle East might have developed as a consequence. But the bottom line was that Eisenhower prevented what could very well have turned into a major world war, and he chose that option. He went against his wartime allies. He went against all sorts of other shorter-term interests because he felt the danger was too great. Now, having blocked Britain and France, Britain had been the military security guarantor of the Middle East, and so there was a vacuum, and Eisenhower filled that with the Eisenhower Doctrine on the Middle East, saying that the United States would guarantee their security. And in order to get the Eisenhower Doctrine passed, is a perfect example of his bipartisan leadership. On New Year's Day, 1956, he went up to the Hill in Congress and met with the leadership of both parties, and he got their support, and within 2 months they had an overwhelming, I mean, just an incredibly overwhelming vote, which... I promised one of you a detour on McCarthyism. This is not, it's not really one of the glowing chapters in Eisenhower's history, at least according to early historians. It is the most prominent case where Eisenhower is accused of not putting principle or country over party. During the 1952 campaign, some of you will remember that Senator McCarthy was accusing everybody of the communist sympathy, including George Marshall, of all people. He accused Marshall of being a traitor, of having sold out China. And Eisenhower was roundly criticized for not publicly repudiating McCarthy's charge, even to the point where it became known that during the campaign he had a paragraph in one of his speeches, I think in Wisconsin, of all places, where McCarthy was from, denouncing McCarthy, and at the last minute he pulled it out. And when he was asked why he did that, he said, "I think it would degrade the presidency for me to give him enough credit that I would denounce him." Now, you can imagine that a lot of people felt that this was spineless and that this was a failure on his part to defend a man whom he idolized and respected against a totally unjust charge. They felt he'd sold out a friend, and that was the way most historians treated it until recently. There are now two new books coming out using recently declassified materials that document all these secret behind-the-scenes maneuvers that Eisenhower undertook that brought McCarthy down. This is a new story, not yet in the public domain. One book is by David Nichols, who was one of the people who validated this presentation. And who's written two books, has a third one coming out that is entirely devoted to Eisenhower's actions in bringing McCarthy down. This will be his third book. And there's another one by Yun Van A. And there is also a book called The Hidden Hand Presidency, a very appropriate title of how Eisenhower worked very quietly behind the scenes. And one of them says he worked like Don Corleone in The Godfather. I mean, you didn't see evidence of what he was doing, but the stilettos were secretly placed. in any event, we'll wait for the publication of these books to see if it really demonstrates that Eisenhower was the primary cause of McCarthy's fall. Eisenhower is reputed to have said that what he did, in retrospect, was to turn McCarthyism into McCarthy-wasm. He occasionally had a good sense of humor. Well, let's turn to domestic policy, and let me tell you why I want to talk about something as trivial as the natural gas bill. This was a bill that Eisenhower favored. It was very much a Republican kind of measure to deregulate federal control of natural gas prices, stimulate the exploration, lower prices for consumers. It was introduced by two Democrats. It was overwhelmingly passed by bipartisan votes in both House and Congress. Eisenhower vetoed his own bill. Why did he do that? Well, here's what he wrote in his own diary, which I'll read in case you can't read it there. He said, "Flagrant bribery and corruption connected with lobbying for this bill by lobbyists who were so arrogant, so much in defiance of acceptable standards of propriety, as to risk creating doubt among American people concerning the integrity of governmental processes." So he vetoed a bill that he wanted. And it does raise the question, how many presidents now would veto a bill they wanted merely because of unseemly lobbying? Civil rights is another subject where historians originally were not too kind to Eisenhower. There are various attributions of things he said or didn't say that he should have said that he really was not an advocate of civil rights. So what I'd like to do is to describe what he did, not what he said, in most cases. He got the first civil rights bill passed in 1957, first civil rights bill in 82 years, and he then got a reinforcing bill passed 3 years later through very intense bipartisan working with Lyndon Johnson and the Democrats. And in passing the bill, you'll notice he got more than a 2-to-1 margin in its favor and had a majority of both Republicans and Democrats supporting him. He appointed the first black to the White House staff. He appointed 5 pro-integration Supreme Court justices, or nominated, and they were approved, one of whom was Earl Warren. And with Herbert Brownell working very closely with him, his attorney general and friend, virtually all of the federal judges that he appointed were anti-segregation judges. He also desegregated every federal institution, every military base, and every school within his authority by executive order. And this was even before Brown versus Board of Education was ruled. He established the first permanent civil rights division in the Justice Department, and more famously, sent federal troops into the South in Little Rock. This is a very controversial and a very significant act and decision on his part. He did it to defend the Constitution, in his view, because a federal court order based on Brown versus Education was being blocked by local authorities. It was the first time since Reconstruction after the Civil War when federal troops entered any Confederate state. So this was quite an act on his part. And this is a picture of the federal troops escorting the girls in school. And this is the headline on the New York Times that day. It says, "President sends troops to Little Rock, federalizes the Arkansas National Guard," although he didn't trust them, which is why he sent in the federal troops that he did trust. And he tells the nation that he acted to avoid anarchy. He did not say he did it to enforce integration, but rather because a federal court order was being violated. Here again, it's worth a footnote about his life. And when you think about somebody doing all of these things, realize that he was born in the 19th century in the South. He grew up surrounded by Southern whites and Southern values about people who were then called Negroes. And yet, he was a pioneer in civil rights. And he implemented the executive order that Truman issued but did not implement. So Ike is very often criticized, as I mentioned, for things he said or was reputed to say or didn't say, but his actions spoke much more powerfully than his words. And now something less controversial. Infrastructure. As George mentioned, he did the interstate highway system. This was based on his experience in the war in Germany, seeing the German Autobahn and beginning to think about how to get it passed politically as a national security measure, which it was justified as, but also to strengthen the economy. It was a major two-year bipartisan effort with an overwhelming vote of support. Less known was the St. Lawrence Seaway, which was built during his time. DARPA, the Defense Research Agency, is actually started on the Internet during the Eisenhower administration, not under some later administrations, as alleged. He started NASA, developed the National Defense Education Act, again through major bipartisan efforts. Some of these, apropos of our earlier conversation, might be attributed to a socialist outlook rather than to a Republican, but these all immeasurably strengthen the infrastructure of the United States. It was the use of government to accomplish things that the private sector could not do on its own. And here he is signing the highway bill. I wanted to add something. It's a different kind of a story. I call it mission over country, but it captures the way in which Eisenhower approached everything. He was very much a planner and very much a visionary of what the major goal was. That's how he united all the different forces in the strange characters that he had to integrate as Supreme Allied Commander during World War II. What is less known, and this is David Eisenhower wanted me to add this, that Eisenhower's leadership of this combined international military force was the first time apparently in world history when foreign armies were fully integrated into one unit with a common command structure. And as the American commander, he could have kept the country separate and simply told them what to do, but he integrated them in a full way. And it's the same notion of having an ultimate vision, whether it's country over party or national interest, it's having mission over his own national identity. The last story I want to tell concerns the Holocaust. Here is a picture of Eisenhower at Ohrdorf, which was one of the dreadful feeder camps to Buchenwald. And you don't have to read the small print. I'll tell you what he said, because to me it is truly remarkable. This is a better picture where you can actually see him. You see mostly soldiers. What he did as the first senior general to visit a Holocaust location was he ordered every photographer and reporter that he had any control of over to come and to photograph and take pictures and record what happened. And he said then on his first day visit, "I am doing this because someday in the future people will deny that this happened, and I want to document it." And that Eisenhower had that vision and that compassion and that understanding on his first visit to the camp, to me, captures a very special spirit of him. His quotation is at the entrance to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, so when you go back, if you do, you'll see it there. And I think that really captures him. So the question that George raised at the beginning is, what's the relevance of all of this for us today? I was a little dumbfounded about how to extrapolate from all of this, so I went to David Eisenhower, who was a great historian. He's a professor in Pennsylvania. And I said, "David, what should I tell people about how this is relevant?" He said, "Well, interestingly, President Kennedy chose a quotation from the National Archives when Jackie was leading the television tour of the White House. And I think if you read this to the group, it will help answer that question." And the quotation is, "History is not a guide to the future, but it gives us confidence, perhaps, that we can do something similar today." And so all I would say is, to the extent to which we can understand the number of times when Eisenhower was put to a decision in which he decided that national interest, the country's welfare, was more important than the short-term appeasement of elements in his own party, is that he chose the higher level goal of the national interest and country, or principle. And what I would suggest is that as we help Americans to understand who Eisenhower was and how he led, it may be an alternative model against which we want to test our future candidates for the presidency. Let me end with a brief comment about the Eisenhower Foundation and what we're doing to carry this message. First, a word about presidential foundations. There are 13 presidential libraries that are owned by the federal government, by the National Archives. And their mission is to collect and preserve, not to educate. Bring people there and use it. But foundations have been created for each of these presidential libraries whose mission is to work with the materials from the libraries and museums, create education programs and help people understand about that president. The Eisenhower Foundation was actually created before Eisenhower was president. Created in 1945 by a group of his admiring friends from Abilene, Kansas, which is why it's located there, unfortunately. It became the presidential library after he retired from the presidency. And it does a fantastic job of bringing in students, all of the high school and college students from Abilene, all 8,000 citizens have been through this, and it's used in schools and colleges throughout Kansas. But to me, more significantly, is it's also used by the Command and General Staff School at Fort Leavenworth, also in Kansas, and I'll mention that in a moment. Last year, the family learned that this foundation, which had really basically been a local Kansas organization, was about to go out of business. They just couldn't engineer much support. And so the four grandchildren, went on the board of the foundation last year to reboot the foundation, as David says, for two things, to make it into two things. One, they wanted to make the foundation national so that the whole country would benefit from this extraordinary library, which I'll describe in a second. But also they wanted it to be the one of the roughly 12 Eisenhower legacy organizations that he either created or that were created in his honor, to be the one that tells the story about Ike's life, his leadership, and his model presidency in that regard. So the vision for the foundation is basically what I've been talking about. The vision is to tell the story of Ike's leadership, how and when he was able to put country and principle over party. Now, what's the Eisenhower Library and Museum? This is a picture, excuse me, of the library, of the museum, I'm sorry. It's a wonderful building.
And right over here in the corner is his home, giving you a sense of how small it is. That's the home that sits in the sky. And that's the
And here's a picture of the library. This is a federal construction. It's a magnificent library. And here's what's in it, and this is truly remarkable. It is the most comprehensive of all the presidential libraries because it not only covers his 8 years president, but his years after the presidency and his 50 years of military career. And here you can see listed the 27 million documents, 550 oral histories, 400,000 photos, 70,000 artifacts, 600,000 feet of motion picture and books. But the collection of papers is basically cataloged by donor. So when Dulles gave his papers, they're all filed under Dulles. When Brownell gave his, they're under Brownell. When George Patton's papers went there. So it makes it really hard if you want to research an issue. So our vision is to try to raise enough money to digitize the important parts of the collection so it's available to everybody online. But in the process of digitization, the metadata that has to be collected would allow you to search for keywords throughout the entire collection. You can do it by issue, by word, by name, or whatever. And so it will increase many times over the value of this collection to the country. We do have now some education programs that are really very exciting. They're under a program called Five Star Leadership. They're both 1 week long, total immersion, experiential learning, where the people in the class are all play one of the key roles. The D-Day, there's one on D-Day where you can play Montgomery or Churchill or Eisenhower or the press asking questions or, you know, soldiers, whatever. And for 1 week, they go through a role play experiencing, and then they have to make the decision whether or not June 6th is the right day to launch the invasion and what the consequences would be. The other one, in some ways, is even more pertinent to more people, and that is the decision to send the troops into Little Rock. It raises the most fundamental issues about the nature of our government structure, its role, the role of the military, the role of civilian leadership, the role of human rights, state rights, federal rights. Those two programs have been used throughout Kansas and in Fort Leavenworth. And our goal and our vision is that those two programs should be made available to every school child in high school and colleges throughout the country and in all the military academies. And we should develop another 10 or 15 programs on other key issues, including some that I've been talking about. So that's our goal. In addition, IBM has volunteered to do a complete study of what needs to be done to make not only the papers, but also the museum artifacts accessible online. We then have to raise a lot of money to get that done. But that's what our vision is. In addition, right now, all of the books that are coming out on Eisenhower, most of them were written by people who went to the library and stayed there for months. You can read glowing tributes to our library in Jim Newton's new book and in David Nichols' books, the ones that are just coming out now. So we want to bring the scholars and the authors, but also all the high school teachers, because right now high school curriculums give a lot of information about Roosevelt and the more recent presidents, but not much is taught about Eisenhower. And our goal is that every American knows as much about Eisenhower as they do about our other modern presidents, and that's far from the case right now. We face a special challenge compared to the other modern presidents. How many of you were alive when Eisenhower was president? Well, welcome. Most of us were kids at the time. We were not mature adults, so our memories of Eisenhower were very partial. And as we say here, of Americans living today, only 17% were alive when Eisenhower was president, and we were mostly kids. So I'm starting today, trying to give this presentation to as many people as I can, to tell them what our vision is for the foundation, and to ask any of you who have any interest in embracing this vision and helping us to carry it out. I'd love to talk to you. I'll stick around a little bit afterward. I'll certainly answer any questions now. And I have a one-page summary of what we're trying to do with the foundation that has my contact information on it, which we can pick it up on your way out. And I have more also if we run out. But I would like at this point to thank you and to open it up to any questions or comments.
And I'd like to remind our audience that we're listening to Dan Sharp, the CEO of the Eisenhower Foundation, giving a talk about Eisenhower's legacy. And we'll open it up for questions. Those who were children at the time, how many remember Eisenhower's speech on TV?
I apologize if this might be a little tangential, but I was a kid during that era, and I think it was 1957. Russia kind of shook the world by putting up Sputnik.
Yes.
And I think the at least prevailing thought at that time was we were asleep at the switch, more or less, with the space program. Just be interested to get your impression on that. Has there been any sort of revisionist history on that, or your comments about the whole, the latter part of the administration, the launching of NASA, and if I recall, the first few years of our efforts were, not necessarily overly encouraging.
Eisenhower's role in this is a little bit controversial still. Wernher von Braun was the principal advocate for us competing with the Russians in space. And he took his argument to Eisenhower, and Eisenhower was not really too enthusiastic about engaging in a space race. He thought that was tangential in terms of power. But he was eventually persuaded to go ahead and support our space program. I have a picture, which is not in this presentation, of him with Wernher von Braun looking at a model of the space that he was doing. So he eventually became a semi-enthusiastic convert, and did, in fact, start NASA.
Sir, thank you very much for your presentation. I'd like to know when on the screen, when you talked about the Internet and DARP, I don't understand what DARP was.
I was afraid someone was going to ask me that, so I went and made a slide to answer that question. Because although I've known about DARPA from my Xerox days for 40 years, I can't remember what it stands for. It's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And it is an official research arm of the Department of Defense and responsible for many good technology things. Thank you for your question. I didn't do the slide in vain.
Sure. They didn't directly work on the Internet. They worked on some kind of internal communication using computers that eventually was used as the base of the...
Yeah, that's as Sarah said. It's just that it was started.
Well, I happened to be at MIT at the time, and DARPA was funding very advanced research, mostly at MIT, and had incredible results. And I think it was fantastic effort on U.S. government to advance many very powerful technologies.
Thank you. Yes, it is a time when people look to government to do things that the private sector could not do as well. Actually, the origins of the Internet was an academic exercise of academic institutions that wanted to communicate with each other. There was no thought of creating a worldwide network at that time. It was simply to enhance research communications among universities. And that's my understanding of it. Yes?
Considering Eisenhower's success in bipartisan legislation and also thinking of lessons for today, did he do a lot of politicking, lobbying amongst, say, the Democrats in Congress to accomplish some of this?
Yes, he did. And he invited opposing congressmen and legislators to dinner frequently at the White House. He engaged on a very creative basis with Lyndon Johnson in great detail. So, I mean, he was constantly talking to both sides of the aisle.
Thank you for coming here. I have a question. Earlier, you were mentioning that, of course, President Eisenhower put country and, I guess,
principle
before party. I know that he was authorizing U-2 spy planes over Russia or over the Soviet Union, and that he knew that they weren't as powerful as we thought they were. But obviously, he couldn't reveal that because the flights were secret. And that was a basis for authorizing more spending on defense and weapons for the United States. How come he didn't oppose that?
How come he didn't oppose what, the U-2 flights?
No, increasing spending for the Defense Department and things like that.
Well, he did. I mean, he had a balanced budget for 6 of his 8 years, and he constantly was controlling the excessive military spending. And yet he did enough military spending that he kept us very strong. So, I mean, he was very conscious, as he mentioned in his farewell address, not to over-militarize the country. But he succeeded in keeping us militarily strong while balancing the budget.
Yes, I was curious if he was very popular during his presidency or if he was more of a polarizing figure. Just kind of comment on that.
I don't think he was a polarizing figure, but he also, I mean, he was a world figure. He was idolized throughout the world. In this country, I wouldn't say that he was either polarizing or overly appreciated at the time. I mean, if you look at what happened in the congressional election, he gradually lost ground with Congress. And if he had been more popular, I think he probably, of course, he was sick a lot, but he could have brought more Republicans with him into Congress.
He did a little better than Churchill, though.
I'm sorry?
I said he did a little better than Churchill did, though.
Well, that's true. Churchill got voted out of office. He just hung around too long. That was his mistake.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just curious, how do you envision bringing Eisenhower's legacy to high school level, you mentioned? Connection, how would you go about it?
The question is, how would we bring this legacy of Eisenhower at the high school level? We're actually doing that now with these two education programs that I described by inserting them into the curriculum in the high school and college, by letting them experience the process that Eisenhower went through in making those two key decisions. And what our ambition is to take a number of the other stories that I was telling you and develop the same kind of one-week curriculum on them so that students are put in the position of having to figure out why did he make that decision, what would I do if I were in that case, and listening to other people playing other roles. So I built the entire Peace Corps training for staff in this fashion, so I know how good it is. We did it all through role-playing. There were no lectures. We were trying to transform people's attitude about serving overseas. And so I know from doing that for 10 years at the Peace Corps that when you put students into a role-playing immersion process, along with the source materials from the time, it is an extraordinary learning experience. I would like to see those two programs on Little Rock and D-Day, plus another dozen programs developed and made available to students throughout the country. I think that's the best way for them to find out who Eisenhower is, by seeing the decisions he made rather than having lectures. Thank you for the question. That's a very important part of our vision.
So there was a recent presentation, I think it was at the Cato Institute, on the 50th anniversary of his farewell speech.
It was at the museum in Washington, D.C.
And I heard segments of that. And this term, of course, the military-industrial complex has kind of been, it's one of these phrases that is probably one of the most famous parts of his speech.
Exactly.
Even though there was much more prior to that and afterwards. But in terms of the kind of largely pejorative connotation of this phrase versus the context of what he was speaking about, and they talked about this on the panel, I was wondering how we could use the anniversary to kind of get a clearer message of what he meant, to provide a more balanced presentation of what the meaning was behind this phrase.
All I can do is endorse your notion that there should be more opportunities for people to understand what his message was. A very positive message. His message was that in order to preserve our democracy and our values, we need to keep a balance between a strong economy and a strong military and not get carried away in one direction or another. I mean, that's a very positive message. But you're quite right, it's been taken as a criticism. And with some validity, as the historians have been telling me about it, is that he was deeply concerned, and the reason he put that into the speech, he was deeply concerned that we were swinging too far towards the military side and that it was going to corrupt the very nature of our society and our democracy. So I'm not sure if I understood your question, other than that I hope there will be more opportunities for people to think about it as they did at the 50th anniversary celebration. I don't know what event. I mean, his birthday is in the middle of October. There's time to do a birthday celebration. We're going to be doing a conference. I wanted to do it on his birthday in October, but it's a little too close to the election. We're going to be doing a conference jointly sponsored with the Franklin Roosevelt House, and with the Carnegie Corporation and the Center for the Study of the Presidency in Washington, D.C., on this topic, on lessons to be learned for today from Eisenhower's legacy. And we'll be inviting all the leading scholars and experts and a lot of prominent journalists to get some publicity to try to carry his message around. And certainly his farewell address will be an issue that will be part of that conference. So that is an opportunity in probably early next year in Washington, and it'll take place in both Washington and New York.
Ironically, I think part of the warning was powerful because he himself was a military man and now in charge, and therefore it seemed that that was something that people were worried about in the nuclear age, that the military was going to take over. And, of course, within a couple of years after he had finished being president, the movies Failsafe and Dr. Strangelove came out, which were also about the takeover by the military. The U.S. government, I think, what happened during the Vietnam War put an end to the idea that they were going to be able to do anything that they wanted to.
Thank you, Drew.
We have time for one last question.
Did Eisenhower have any thing to say about his immediate successors?
He certainly did. And this is now coming out in declassified form. I'm in the middle of his grandson's book about his post-presidency years, and David has a lot of very salty quotes in there. His initial impression of Kennedy was that he was immature, unprepared for the job. He was really very critical of me in private. But he made a vow a respectful vow of silence, very much like George W. Bush did, at least in the first year, criticizing. And he also corresponded with Kennedy fairly regularly. Kennedy called him and brought him in, and they talked. And over time, he developed a little bit more respect. But, I mean, he thought the way Kennedy handled the Bay of Pigs was unconscionable and was very critical of that. And he just felt he was immature and unprepared. But Kennedy had enough sense to continue to consult him. And Eisenhower signed a letter to Kennedy saying, when it comes to foreign policy, I will support you. And this was in the days, you remember the phrase, that the political differences on foreign policy stop at the edge of the ocean. And Eisenhower honored that very much. There's some pretty salty quotes if you want the exact language. One of the things you learn about Eisenhower is he had a horrible temper. We think of him as this quiet, grandfatherly, he wasn't a career soldier for nothing.
That's a great place to end. I'll change the image slightly. It's always great when there's an image and the facts are uncovered so that the details become a little bit clearer. But at the same time, again, to put it in perspective, there's always some mess going on, and if there's somebody that can lead in a way that takes us through the mess in a fairly coherent way, that's just great. So anyway, thank you very much again for coming, and thank you, Dan, for a great, great talk on Eisenhower.
Thank you very much. I encourage you to pick up a summary sheet, if you will. It has my contact information. If any of you have any interest at all in working with us and helping us to carry this vision forward, I would very much like to hear from you. And I'll stick around a little bit if any of you want to chat.
Great. And so ends another event in the 108th year of enlightened discussion at the Commonwealth Club of California.
George, thank you. You're a great moderator.
Thanks.